It is Monday, July the 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Iran sentences a Chinese American to prison.
It's a part of the pattern of the judiciary, usually in the second term of moderate or reformist presidents in power, to really basically tie them down.
Also ahead, concerns in Moscow.
Russia right now is highly concerned that its previous actions are now going to start to backfire on Russia.
Tensions in Venezuela, plus some music from another time. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iran has imprisoned a Chinese-American man, 37-year-old Xiyue Yong, for 10 years, after accusing him of infiltrating the country. They also have detained President Hassan Rouhani's brother. Hossein Faradun is in custody over allegations of financial impropriety and the possible result of a long-standing feud between Iran's two centers of power. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Indiana University Iran scholar Hussein Banai if this is what it's all about.
It looks like it. There's a long tradition of the judiciary in Iran pushing back against establishment figures by going after their business ties, but also business ties of their family members as a way to kind of pull them back from any kind of emboldened agenda or a sense of independence they might have in the executive.
Now, he played a rather crucial role in the nuclear talks of 2015. He's also been a key advisor to Mr. Rouhani.
He has. He was a constant presence during multiple rounds of diplomatic negotiations with the U.S. delegation. He was often pictured alongside Iran's foreign minister next to then Secretary of State John Kerry at the talks, and was thought to have been a kind of a direct line to the president himself, even much more so than Zarif was during the talks.
Do you see this as trying to delegitimize the May victory of Mr. Rouhani's reelection?
I think it is more the case to kind of remind Rouhani of where the levers of power in the regime are, and to broadcast that obviously widely to his supporters. But I think that the real message of this is really internal. It's meant to make sure that the Rouhani cabinet kind of stays in check, and that the president himself doesn't get any ideas, and that basically the independence of the executive branch is not exerted in a bold way in the system. The judiciary has always played that role.
Well, as you know, this comes at the same time that Iran imprisoned, sentenced to 10 years, a Chinese-American for infiltrating the country. This is just the latest American that's been detained and imprisoned.
Yes. This is, again, it's a part of the pattern of the judiciary, usually in the second term of moderate or reformist presidents in power, to really basically tie them down in a kind of a akin to Lilliputians tying down Gulliver in their second term. And especially since Iran now has a lot more at stake, both regionally and in terms of the domestic considerations that it has to make with respect to all these contracts that have to be signed with foreign companies after the nuclear deal. This is a way for the hardline judiciary to basically do the bidding of hardliners in the system, since they don't have representation in the executive branch.
This can't help U.S.-Iranian relations at all.
No, but they are pretty much on ice as they stand since the general election here in the United States in 2016. But it's one of those things that, frankly, Democrat and Republican administrations both have to consider. Iran's judiciary has always played this kind of interventionary role in the relations between Iran and outside countries. And so it's part of a kind of a normal fare, although this time around it is Obviously, it bears special significance because of the nuclear deal and the fact that the Rouhani family was just so intimately involved in not just negotiating it, but also seeing it through after the sanctions were lifted.
Hussein Banai is a professor at Indiana University whose research focuses on Iran's political development as well as U.S.-Iranian relations. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans lined up across the country and in expatriate communities around the world to vote in a symbolic referendum to reject President Nicolas Maduro's plan to rewrite the Constitution, a proposal that is raising tensions in a nation already battered by shortages and anti-government protest. We asked Rice University Latin American scholar Mark Jones about the referendum.
This is a counterattack by the opposition to the government's attempt to effectively rewrite the Constitution through a undemocratic constituent assembly where the delegates to the constituent assembly will be chosen by sectoral groups and manipulated in such a way that the government is assured of having an absolute majority. And therefore, if the constituent assembly is held, the Constitution will be rewritten in such a way that it will lock Chavistas into power forever, or at least as long as they can hold power.
We also asked him about the ongoing public protests by those opposing the Maduro government.
Venezuela is a very tragic case. It stands out over the last 50 years as one of the sharpest drops in standards of living in a country that hasn't experienced civil war or some type of other military conflict, where we've seen the standard of living drop dramatically. People are having a hard time getting access to food and basic health care. And the political system's going from one that was once one of the shining examples of democracy in Latin America to an increasingly authoritarian regime that's starting to look a lot more like Cuba than, say, Costa Rica or Canada.
Dr. Jones also commented on a question about whether the Organization of American States, the OAS, or the U.S. can do anything about the situation in Venezuela.
It's very difficult because the United States is seen, not without some reason, by the Chavista government of Nicolas Maduro as being pro-opposition and thus not being a neutral actor. The OAS has become, I think, compromised as well and is rather weak. And unless countries like Brazil, which is beset by its own internal problems, as well as others such as Argentina and Chile and Mexico, really make an active effort to promote dialogue, I think we're unlikely to see any international forces bring reconciliation in Venezuela. I think that's in part due to the fact that the Maduro government and some of the hardline Chavistas don't want any reconciliation. That is, and that's really bedeviled the opposition over the past 3 to 5 years, where they've tried to work within the democratic system to effect change. And what they've increasingly realized is that they're never going to be able to actually negotiate, come to some type of consensual agreement with Nicolas Maduro and hardline Chavistas because they aren't willing to make any compromise whatsoever. And so I think that's what's led to today's plebiscite, is that the opposition is realizing that they need to engage in more civil disobedience and that they can't rely on simply democratic means to remove Maduro from power. That is, they need to create a climate of civil unrest in Venezuela such that the Maduro government will be unable to hold their constituent assembly elections at the end of July and rewrite the Constitution. And today's plebiscite was a launching pad to use the 5 to 6 million votes in favor of the opposition's position as a legitimizing device to allow them to engage in active civil disobedience in Venezuela with the goal of blocking the Maduro government's attempt to rewrite the Constitution, as well as signaling to international actors the strong support within the Venezuelan population for a democratic change in opposition to the Maduro's government.
Mark Jones holds the Joseph D. Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies and is a professor in the Department of Political Science at Rice University. President Trump's attorney insists there was nothing illegal in the meeting Mr. Trump's son, Donald Jr., had with a Russian lawyer during last year's presidential campaign. The younger Trump's willingness to meet with the lawyer in the expectation of receiving incriminating information about presidential candidate and from the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, has raised new questions about possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And all of this begs the question, did Russia interfere in the U.S. election? And if so, what was their underlying motive? International Edition's Lori London asks Lauren Goodrich, senior Eurasia analyst, and Soviet Union specialist at Stratfor, if multiple Russia meddling investigations here in the U.S. could create headaches for Moscow.
Russia right now is highly concerned that its previous actions, it's hybrid warfare tactic actions, which all these meetings kind of fall underneath, are now going to start to backfire on Russia. We're seeing it start to backfire in the Senate starting to push through a bill to expand sanctions on Russia. And we're also seeing it backfire with the EU and the United States talking about creating actual units to go counter Russian propaganda and Russian personalities that do these kind of dubious meetings.
The likelihood of sanctions being lifted, which it seemed like after President Trump met with Putin, he was sort of looking to push the Senate to lighten up on the new sanctions. I would imagine that would not be too wise to do at this point.
It wouldn't, but it's whether Trump can have Congress do it instead. That's the next key arena to really watch, is whether Congress is going to be watering down these sanctions for Trump. And what will be important is to also watch is that there are many other bills in the works within the Senate that if Congress does start to water down these sanctions, there are other bills that could be introduced and start to be pushed forward against Russia. And some have very, very strict and stringent consequences that are even harsher than these sanctions.
It would seem that they really wanted those sanctions lifted, and that was in part part of their plan.
Getting the sanctions lifted is part of their long-term plan, but not their short-term plan. Russia right now isn't really suffering due to the current sanctions. The current EU and U.S. sanctions are really only affecting about 0.5% of GDP, of Russian GDP. But what Russia's starting to think about is the long-term effects. And the long-term effects are that it really curbs Russia's ability to produce oil in very difficult regions of Russia that they need the Western firms to work in. And so they're thinking not, let's get the sanctions lifted now for right now, but we need the sanctions lifted somewhere in the middle term in order to make sure that it doesn't hurt Russia really hard and stay five.
Were the sanctions part of their strategy when they looked to interfere in the U.S. elections?
Very much so. The sanctions were one part of it, but the bigger part, more than the sanctions, was really worrying about the future of Russia's borderlands. And that's what they were really hoping as far as whether they could have a more friendly and negotiable relationship with the U.S. government was, can we get the United States to shift its foreign policy in the borderlands, or can we create enough doubt within the U.S.-Russian relations for those borderland countries to start reconsidering about their future and whether they need to deal with Russia and not be able to rely on the United States. They didn't get the former. They didn't get someone who is going to work easier with Russia, but they are still trying to work as far as the doubt and the chaos within the U.S.-Russian relationship in order to make those borderland countries think that they still need to deal with Russia and not rely on the United States. And that was something that was thwarted at the G20 meeting in which, yes, there was very good optics between, you know, Presidents Trump and Putin. However, as soon as the G20 was over, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson went straight to Ukraine in order to kind of quell any fears out of Kiev that the U.S. and Russia were kind of working on mending their relationship.
Lauren Goodrich is a senior Eurasia analyst and Soviet Union specialist at Stratfor. She was speaking with my colleague Lori London. According to a new report from the British analyst group Royal United Services Institute, policies on sanctions targeting rogue states risk being ineffective due to a lack of coordination between the European Union and the United States. Henry Ridgewell is in London with the story.
North Korea's recent test of an intercontinental ballistic missile prompted the United States to push for new sanctions against both Pyongyang and the foreign firms that Washington says provide it with an economic lifeline. The fragmented nature of international sanctions, enforced separately by the UN, the United States, and the European Union, renders them less effective against Pyongyang, argues report author Emil Dahl.
It relies on a complex network of overseas front companies, shell companies, agents that are acting on behalf of the North Korean regime, people that are simply not captured on sanctions lists.
Dahl notes recent examples of effective coordination. It's 2 years since the so-called P5 plus one countries, the United States, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom plus Germany, signed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran. That agreement saw some EU and US sanctions lifted in return for limits on Tehran's nuclear program. The United States and Europe have also implemented similar sanctions against Russian individuals and companies following Moscow's forceful takeover of Crimea and invasion of eastern Ukraine. But the nature of the European Union means targets are often able to evade sanctions.
You've got all member states who have to agree unanimously to imposing new sanctions. In the European Union, there is also the prospect of legal challenges in the European courts.
US sanctions are more adaptable as rogue states try to evade the measures.
The US is able to more rapidly put in place new measures and new designations that counteracts that. The solution is closer communication, both between the US and the EU on sanctions regimes, but it's also closer communication with the private sector. At the end of the day, the private sector is the implementer of sanctions.
Britain's EU exit complicates the picture. The report says London will be able to move more quickly in imposing and adapting sanctions outside the EU. But any measures will have less clout without European enforcement. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thousands of people rallied in Warsaw to oppose the Polish government's controversial new court reforms, which opponents see as a threat to judicial independence. That law gives lawmakers a dominant role in appointing judges, a move that opposition parties and rights groups said would make jurists subject to political influence. New legislation has drawn criticism from the European Union, which says that it violates judicial independence. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
If you're in pain and need some relief, researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Boston Children's Hospital propose that instead of reaching for a pain pill, you just may need more sleep. The researchers, who detailed their findings in the journal Nature Medicine, also suggest that in the absence of adequate sleep, improved alertness through caffeine use, for example, could also help make you feel better. In their experiments on mice, the scientists gauged the effects of sleep loss on how sensitive the animals were to both painful and non-painful stimulation. After testing usual pain blockers like ibuprofen and then stimulant agents like caffeine, the researchers say they were able to find out how alertness played a role in lowering the sensitivity of the mice to pain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In a report from the music department, it's the story of a group that came on the scene in the 1960s and entertained people for decades to follow.
Bill,
Coup, Billy Davis Jr., Ronald Townsend, Florence LaRue, and Lamont McLemore, The Fifth Dimension. They're an American popular music group whose repertoire included pop, R&B, soul, jazz, light opera, and even Broadway. Their style, often called Champagne Soul.
I love you so, I always will. And in your voice I hear a choir of carousels. But am I ever gonna hear my wedding bells?
Formed as the Versatiles in late 1965, the group changed its name to the Fifth Dimension the next year. They became well known during the late 1960s and early 70s for their popular hits such as Wedding Bell Blues. Some of the songwriters for The Fifth Dimension went on to big careers of their own, including Jimmy Webb, who penned their 1967 hit, Up, Up, and Away.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride?
In 1975, McCoo and Davis, who had been married since July of 1969, left the group to be out on their own. The original quintet reunited in 1990 and 1991 for a tour, and by 2009, the group was actively touring as The Fifth Dimension featuring Florence LaRue, led by LaRue and four new singers. The Fifth Dimension remains one of the top downloads on music sites, especially their super hit, One Less Bell to Answer. Marilyn McCoo, great voice. Still sounds good even today. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope that you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday. Now a bit more of The Fifth Dimension.
It just can't.
I still run. less egg to fry.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
July 11th marked the sixth anniversary of South Sudan's independence. But South Sudan and its people are suffering. The treasury is empty. And so President Salva Kiir canceled the celebration. Although a number of issues have complicated the situation, South Sudan's problems are largely man-made. Much of it can be blamed on South Sudan's leaders, who are unwilling to set aside personal differences and political ambitions for the good of the country. In one way or another, South Sudan has been the scene of fighting for over half a century. The Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005 ended the Second Civil War that pitted South Sudanese rebels against the government in Khartoum. The referendum for independence 6 years later led to the birth of South Sudan, ushering in an era of hope and optimism for the war-weary population. But peace in the new country lasted less than 18 months. In December 2013, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar erupted into civil war as the country split along ethnic lines. A 2015 peace agreement and a transitional government formed in early 2016 failed to end the violence. The fighting that continues today has led to a collapsing economy, food insecurity, hunger, malnutrition, and imposed unimaginable violence on the South Sudanese. Today, some 6 million people, more than half the country's population, live with extreme food insecurity. 4 million have been displaced, the majority of them children. And around 300,000 people, the vast majority of them civilians, have been killed. The birth of South Sudan in 2011 was marked by hope for a peaceful and prosperous future, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. We deeply regret that the second chance made possible by the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity in April 2016 was squandered. Following the collapse of the permanent ceasefire in July 2016, the armed conflict expanded across the country, and the parties to the conflict remain unwilling to return to the negotiating table, she said. The United States remains deeply committed to a stable and inclusive South Sudan, and stresses once again that there is no military solution to this conflict. On this day, meant to celebrate South Sudan's creation, we call upon South Sudan's leaders and all parties to end this self-destructive violence, to return to political dialogue, and to help South Sudan realize its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.